Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Zen Center, if you're new. Welcome to Zen Center, if you're not. We are in Sesshin. Zen Center's in Sesshin this weekend, the traditional silent retreat. So our routine this morning is just a little bit different. We won't have questions or comments at the end of the talk. And we won't have tea and social hour like we normally do. So I apologize for that. But please don't see it as unfriendly. We're just silently friendly this week. And next week, we'll talk your ear off. We're just saving up a bunch of really good stuff to say. So please join us. So we have been talking about a teaching poem, an ode, a song from about 250 years ago, written by a Zen master named Hakuin. For those of you who are familiar with Zen, you will certainly know the name Hakuin. And if you're unfamiliar, that's okay. I think the teaching will come across clearly anyway. And on the front of your program are just the few lines that I pulled out that I want to talk about. There's a huge amount here, so I'll cover as much as I cover today. But what I thought might be fun is to start by chanting that together. It is not the entire piece, but that's the piece of the poem I'm going to try to touch on today. So if you don't have it in front of you, look on with a neighbor or just listen. But it's a lovely piece, and I think it might be nice for you to hear these words coming out of your mouth. Because on one level, these are 250 years old. But in another way, they're not. And they don't belong to Hakuin, and they belong to you. And it's much better if you hear your soft, warm, round mouth make these sounds, because they're yours. So let's just chant this together. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. We wander through the six worlds, from dark path to dark path. When shall we be freed from birth and death? Boundless and free is the sky of samadhi, bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Thank you. Thank you. I was telling the group yesterday, because we chanted the whole thing. We've been doing it as part of our midday liturgy, and then we chanted it before the talk yesterday. And what I told the group is I've been chanting this on my own at home for a couple of years now, just to memorize it and kind of get it in my bones. It's a good way of meeting Dharma is to just chant it every day for quite a while, and just sort of see what it does to you. Store it inside your body and see what it moves. But I've actually never heard it in my life chanted out loud before yesterday. We had like 20 people, right, I think, chant it. And now today, oh, look at all of us. Wow. It's even better than I thought. All right. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about the first segment, because that's what I spent all my time on yesterday. And then I'll, just to bring you guys up to speed, if you weren't part of the session. So Hakuin, our author here, our poet, our artist, calls this a song, the Song of Zazen. So if you're interested in reading this whole piece when you get home, you can look up Song of Zazen by Hakuin. It's a song. Maybe I won't say anything more about that, but I hope that frames the way you take this in. It's a song. It's a song. It's a song. And of course, it was written in Japanese, and the translation that I'm using here is by Norman Waddell. I do not read Japanese, but I've read about a dozen translations of this piece into English, and they're remarkably similar. There's a few words where there's variance, but for the most part, this piece seems to be a little more, I don't know, concrete isn't quite the right word, but perhaps a little more easily translatable into English, I don't know, because they're remarkably similar, the translations. So we'll work with the English that we have in front of us, and he starts by saying, all beings by nature are Buddha. And if we are new to Buddhism, if we're new to Zen Buddhism, or if we are old hats at this and have been doing it for a long time, I think we still find this shocking. It's the party line. It's certainly the understanding that's been offered for the 250 years since Hakuin, but it goes back 250 years before that. This is the original teaching of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago. I, along with all beings, awaken, is the teaching of the Buddha. And Dogen puts it as, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. That's the party line. That's the core teaching. You're Buddha. And so when we come to a Zen center, we come to a Buddhist center, and we're met with this idea, you're already Buddha. You just sort of think, well, then why would I be here? I don't understand. And this teaching, you know, on paper, when I read it, I feel comforted. Oh, that's a nice idea. But in actual practice, this is what I was saying yesterday, it feels like somebody's put a little piece of sand inside my oyster. I actually find it a little irritating. Not irritating like, but irritating like, I don't know what? That doesn't make sense. Maybe you don't know me. Maybe you don't know me, right? Because I'm a mess. So perhaps I can get to the idea that everybody else is Buddha. Oh, look at you all. From this seat, it's really easy to see that there are 60 Buddhas in this room. That's really easy. What's harder for most of us is to include this one, right? The one on the cushion. All beings are Buddha. So it's actually it's kind of a way of afflicting us. We're very comfortable with our suffering. We're very comfortable excluding ourselves from the circle. Strangely, right? There's suffering there, but we're so used to it, it's a hell we know. It's a hell we know. Very comfortable hell. So when someone says, oh, by the way, that's not true. You are in. This is the circle of beings. This is the circle of Buddha. All beings are that. You are one of them. We actually can feel afflicted by this. Even though the words are comforting, we're just so challenged by this idea that we realize, if this is actually true, what have I based my life on? A profound misunderstanding. Oh, wow. If this is actually true, if I had to live from this place, how much of my life would have to get turned upside down? Right? What if that was actually true? I mean, if you actually deeply understood in your bones, you are Buddha, what would change in your life? Wow. So, do you kind of get where I'm going with the affliction part? Like, this teaching's kind of a poke, right? So this is you wanting to sleep in past your alarm, and this is your grandma poking you, saying, sweetie, wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Right? Don't go back to sleep. So we're being poked. It's a powerful and brave first line. All beings by nature are Buddha. So the goal of this teaching is not, of course, to memorize that line and then just assert it. I'm Buddha. Oh, I don't have to go back to sensor anymore. That's session's over, you guys. We can all go home. That isn't quite it, because there are realized Buddhas and there are unrealized Buddhas, and the point of this is not to give us an off-ramp. The point of this is to give us an on-ramp. Right? We practice because we are Buddha. If we practiced in order to become Buddha, we'd be off the hook. But we don't. We practice because we are. So this is the beginning of practice. It's the beginning of the song. It's the beginning of the teaching. It's the beginning of Buddhism. So, we work with teachings like this until we can hold both sides of the coin that we've been handed with some degree of contentment. And side number one is, you're perfect just as you are. And side number two is, you could use some improvement. Side number one is, you are Buddha. Side number two is, and now practice. Keep polishing, right? And those are hard for us to hold at the same time. That's what we were talking about yesterday. But that's the invitation here. We can't throw one of those two away. Where it's like heaven and earth being rent asunder, as Dogen says. So, the other thing we talked about yesterday is that Hakuin has said beings. Most of us in this room have probably already translated that into humans. But he did not say humans. He said beings. And I don't know, again, what the original Japanese is. But Zen spends a lot of time with phrases like beings, sentient beings. And those are different than humans. So Hakuin has not said, all men, all males by nature are Buddha. He has not said all Japanese people by nature are Buddha. He has not said all Buddhists by nature are Buddha. He has not said all humans by nature are Buddha. He says all beings. Isn't that interesting? That's quite an assertion. And so immediately we ask, oh, well, then what's a being? Because we kind of want to know who's in and who's out and whether or not we're in. Right? I assume we're all doing that. Well, okay, humans are in. We're beings. Oh, okay, birds, sure. Squirrels, mm-hmm. I don't know about sharks. They seem mean. Plants, sure. If I'm feeling magnanimous, they're sentient. What about rocks? Are rocks in the circle of beings? How about viruses? How about clouds? How about emotions when you're sad? Is that a being? Is that Buddha or is that excluded? How about thoughts? Your mind wandered during Zazen. Was that Buddha? Or is that out? How about the past? Think about your past. Is that a being? Is that included? Your ideas about the future, your hopes? Is that a being? So, as I was saying yesterday, I think this is an interesting question to spend some time examining because it's designed to expand our inclusivity, right? We draw the circle of family too small, Mother Teresa says. That's the problem with the human race. We just draw our family circle too small. If you draw your family circle big enough, you take care of everything. Ta-da! Right? He's kind of saying the same thing. So I would recommend engaging with this question, what's a being? For maybe about 5 minutes tops. Because it's a trick, you guys. Don't kill it. You already know the answer. He said all beings. So there's your answer. And if you find something that doesn't belong in the circle of beings, that's a being. So it's actually not worth spending much time on. All beings includes the great earth. All beings means all beings. So any playing we do with questions like this, they just show us our mind. They just show us our mind. Right? All beings are Buddha means existence itself has awakening nature. Existence itself is awakening nature. So, our translation also says Buddha, and not Buddhas. All beings are Buddhas. He doesn't say that. He says Buddha. It's translated as Buddha. Isn't that interesting? We're taking the plurality and turning it into a singularity. The multiplicity and turning it into, right? Differentiation and turning it into unity. That's interesting to me. Our practice is verified by Buddha, and our practice verifies Buddha. This is a teaching about non-separation. And I don't know, of course, what was in his heart when he wrote this, but I have this idea that people being people, that if I thought I was a Buddha, and Mary Beth is a Buddha, and Chris is a Buddha, I might start going, I wonder which one of us is most Buddha. You know? We kind of have a tendency to do that. But if I say I'm Buddha, and Mary Beth is Buddha, and Chris is Buddha, I don't. Right? There's nothing there to separate. So, so we're going to move on. I'm on page 5 of my talk already, you guys. I'm skipping so much, I just got to get this in. Plus, the folks who have been here have already heard that first part. So we'll skip on to the truth of suffering. The truth of suffering, this is the first noble truth, it is the origin of Buddhism. The first noble truth, the universality of the experience of suffering. And he talks about that by saying, we wander through the 6 worlds, from dark path to dark path. When shall we be freed from birth and death? Thank goodness he puts this in here, right? So at least we know this guy's human and he knows what he's talking about. Because if all he had said is, everything is Buddha, I'm done, you'd be like, you just don't get it, dude. I don't know what you're basing that on. But the interesting thing about where this comes in the poem, it comes about a third of the way in, and it's the first time he said we. He uses an inclusive pronoun, and again, this is the American translator. But He's not observing from afar. He's including himself in this circle. We wander through the six worlds. He's talking about suffering. Does your life ever feel like dark path to dark path to dark path to dark path? Yes, it does. I don't even know you, and I know that that's true. Of course it does. Sometimes it doesn't feel that way, but sometimes it does. When shall we be freed from birth and death, the cycle, the endless cycle? Whether we believe in reincarnation or not, we know what this is. Oh, I went to sleep and I woke up again in another one. Urgh. The same challenging relationships, the same dead-end job, the same feeling of existential angst, the same sadness, the same fear, the same, right? Birth and death over and over. When will I be free of suffering? When will I be free of that? He uses the metaphor of the six worlds or the six realms, which is a very old teaching. It goes all the way back to the historical Buddha. And these are talked about as realms of suffering. This is realms of suffering. And they all have their own flavor. In some forms of Buddhism, these are thought of as physical, literal places that we can come from or be born into. And in other schools of Buddhism, we talk about them as psychological states. We have hell. We have hungry ghosts. We have fighting spirits. We have animals. We have heaven. And we have humans. Those are the six realms. And they're all talked about as suffering. And if there was such a thing as the right one, the desirable one, it's the last one, human. Because in the human realm, there's just enough suffering to motivate us to practice, to cultivate compassion. But there's not so much that we're crushed. Human realm is the desirable realm, which is funny because in our culture, because we have sort of Judeo-Christian common consciousness, whether we were raised in that tradition or not, you go, hold on a minute, one of those was heaven. I heard you say heaven back just a minute ago. That's the sweet one. Come on, man. Right? The reason the heaven realm is talked about as a realm of suffering is because when we are incredibly comfortable, compassion can die. It's very difficult, if you think about it. If you're having a fantastically good day and you're just unbelievably comfortable, and somebody comes to you with a broken heart, you probably want to go later. Get off my cloud, because I got this thing going. Right? I'll get back to you when I'm miserable. We can commiserate. Right? We'll be miserable together. Co-misery. Co-miserate. Right? But right now, I got this thing going. And I don't want you to... And if we think about that, comfort doesn't necessarily mean the death of compassion. But the heaven realm is talked about as a realm of suffering because there's no incentive to practice. So if you're at Zen Center today, you're here on some level because you suffer. That's why you're here. Duh. I mean, it is a duh. It's worth saying now and again. I like Norm Fisher's way of saying it. We have religion because we die. Think about it. Why else would we? Why even ask the big question? If you live forever and never suffered, you sure wouldn't go to Zen Center. Come on, man, you'd be at the lake. So, the six realms, we wander. Oh, I had a really good day, then I had a really bad day, then I had that day I was so hungry, then I had a day I just wanted to be in bed, and there was a day I just wanted to fight, 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 and then there was a day I was lonely, and then there was a day I felt really good again, and then I was... But on some level, we just go, God, does this ever end? It's just endless cycle. It's endless cycling. Will I ever be free of it? Why do I feel like I'm a victim of this, right? There's our koan. This is the great human koan. It's the origin of Buddhism. Suffering, what do we do? So what I like about this is he includes this cry, this great cry that we all do, this great cry. And everybody gets this. So before I move on to the third part, what I will say is that this is a Mahayana Buddhist song, teaching, poem, expression. And the Mahayana Buddhist relationship with suffering is just a little bit different than some of the original teachings on suffering. And in Mahayana Buddhism, suffering, you can hear it in my voice, it's the way I've been taught to think about it and talk about it is the common ground that connects all of us. It is the one experience every human has had. Relationship between us would be fundamentally impossible if we had not experienced suffering. I mean, if I had suffered and you had somehow magically never suffered, which is actually almost literally inconceivable, but let's just imagine you had never suffered, I actually don't know that communication would even be possible, because our relationship with suffering informs every single thing about our life. Everything. Right? Our wanting to get away from the thing that's not life-sustaining, that's painful, the part of us that wants to move toward the thing that is sustaining, that's the basis of human consciousness. So our understanding of suffering in the Mahayana tradition is there is a capacity in the experience of suffering itself that's fertile. It's fertile. It's not an enemy to be vanquished or amputated or extinguished. It's fertile soil in which to plant the seeds of compassion, the seeds of connection. If you meet me and you have a broken heart and my heart starts to break with yours, right, we are in the same place. We understand each other. Compassion, connection is possible because of that shared experience, right? If I had never suffered, I wouldn't even have that capacity. So this is a difficult thing for us, because when we start doing any kind of spiritual practice, Zen or otherwise, we almost universally think, this is the thing I want to end and kill and amputate and leave behind. I want to go to the place where it never hurts. Right? That's why we're here. At least that's why I was here. I say was because I kind of gave up on the Enlightenment Project a while ago. But, you know, when I first walked through the door, I was aware enough to go, wow, my life feels like a hot mess most of the time. I'm suffering a great deal. And if I do this thing called Zen practice, I'm going to have this experience called Enlightenment, and then I won't suffer anymore. And you know what? That sounds pretty good. And that's what I was in it for, right? And I was in it, and I was in it, and I was told right away, well, that's not the way we... But I went, yeah, whatever. No, I've read the books. Come on, man. And I stuck around and stuck around and stuck around and stuck around, and at some point kept sticking around, but I gave up on this idea of seeing suffering as an enemy. Of seeing suffering as an enemy. So, when we start to regard our suffering as not a foe, but a teacher... When we start to regard our suffering as fertile soil, when we start to regard our suffering as the wise part of our brain, the wise part of our heart, the wise part of mind itself, saying there's something universal happening here. How do you want to regard me? Will you ignore me? Will you distract yourself from me? Will you suppress me? Will you repress me? Will you run away? Will you say no? Will you shut the door? Or is your Buddha big enough to include this? Right? So that's kind of how we talk about this stuff sometimes. And we move on to the promise of freedom. That is the basis of Buddhism, the universality of suffering and the promise of freedom. And one of the ways he talks about it here is the third little part of the verse that I put on your program, boundless and free. Is the sky of samadhi, bright the full moon of wisdom. This call of despairing that we do, when will we be free, has a response. It has a response. Buddhism offers a response. Buddhism offers medicine. Boundless and free is the sky of samadhi. Samadhi is a fancy word. It's Sanskrit, for those of you who don't know it. I won't spend too much time on it. It's usually translated as absorption. Which is my preferred, sometimes concentration. But it's essentially, the way he's using it here, I see it as him using it as a synonym for zazen, as a synonym for meditation, the boundless field. And we chose this verse, part of this, and when I say we, I mean American Zen practitioners, as part of our liturgy, as part of one of our long liturgies. So for those of you who have been here on a Saturday, you've heard the longer version of our service that includes, it's a transition piece between chanting the male ancestors to beginning to chant the female ancestors, which is also an American tradition, something that America has offered to this ancient tradition that I think is incredibly valuable. And so as we're chanting it, we start to introduce a pitch rise and fall. because all of the chanting in Zen is done the way we did earlier on one note, bup, 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 on the syllable. And then at a certain point in the Saturday service, we're about to move into the female ancestors, and all of a sudden there's a little bit of a sing-song quality, which changes the energy. And they chose, the people who wrote this, chose some of this passage from Hakuin, a Rinzai guy, for our service. Isn't that cool? So that part of the service goes, the sky of samadhi and the moonlight of wisdom form the temple of our practice. Our friends and family members guide us as we walk the ancient path. We express our heartfelt gratitude and acknowledge our debt to all successive Buddhas and ancestors who have transmitted the authentic Dharma, including the great matriarchs, and we pay homage to the mother of all Buddhas, Prajnaparamita. So, not a complicated melody. You probably figured it out already, right? But kind of nice. Starts being nice. We talk about Prajnaparamita. We talk about samadhi. We talk about the temple that is Zazen, the temple of our practice. He's offering us now the medicine for the cry. This is the response. This is the response. We're starting to move into our relationship with working with the mind. We're starting to move into our relationship with Zazen, with seated meditation. So the sky of samadhi and the moonlight of wisdom. The way I describe this, and this is just personal, this is just me. The way I describe this is perhaps wonder. I think meditation can lead us to a place of wonder. I think meditation can lead us to the gradual or sudden experience of becoming bigger inside, just bigger inside. I think it makes us more susceptible, perhaps vulnerable even to our experience, maybe more easily pierced by the truth of our experience. I call that wonder, but when we have an experience of wonder, we step outside of our normal way of looking. Most of us describe that, if we're asked to, as some place where the walls of self begin to collapse in the normal way. It's harder to have ownership over wonder, at least it is for me. I find it pretty easy to own my pain and to pretend that it's mine. My heartbreak, you can't have it, it's mine. Right? Pain, my limited, smaller ideas are just easier for me to own and pretend that they're mine. But huge ones, really, really, really big experiences of love or of gratitude or of grace or of wonder, they're harder for me to own. If I pull up to the Grand Canyon and go, it's kind of hard for me to go, I am experiencing wonder at this because I am Busho. You're probably not going to get it. Right? But there's a really friggin' big canyon here. Right? It's harder for me to kind of own that. It takes me to a transpersonal place. And it stretches me. You know what I mean? Like when you see the Grand Canyon, which I actually have never seen in real life. I don't know why I always use that as my example. I've seen pictures, though. It's amazing, right? I almost feel like physically stretched inside. Even to behold something like that, you just feel like, I mean, I'm aware I can't take it in. Not literally the canyon, the experience. I can't take it in, so I'm up against my own edges. This is how big you are, Busho. This is how big you are. You know, we have the same experience in a lot of different ways in life. It doesn't have to be the Grand Canyon. And this practice that we do, this Zen practice, makes us much more susceptible to wonder. And it doesn't have to be the big cataclysmic Grand Canyon wonder. I mean, it can show up big. That's cool. But, you know, it can be small. It can be much more humble than that. It can just be holding that cup of tea and feeling the warmth of it and noticing, wow, I'm holding it with both hands because it's so hot. And it's asking for more care. than a regular beverage that's at room temperature, so I've got both hands on it. And the cup was made by somebody, and the tea was brewed by somebody, and brought to me by somebody. Do you know what I mean? When moments like that show up, and you just, wow. I don't know, what's our response to that? Thank you, I guess? Thank you. But you have a sense you're moving into a place that's bigger than just you. There's something fundamental about that. And that's how I like to think of Prajnaparamita, fundamental. Prajnaparamita is, Prajna is wisdom, usually translated as wisdom. And paramita is the perfection of or going beyond. So the perfection of wisdom, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom. And it's usually regarded with a feminine pronoun in this language, she, the womb, because Prajnaparamita is regarded as the womb of the Buddhas. And with womb, it's pretty easy for us to go to feminine, right? The womb of the Buddhas, that thing that we know before we know, the thing that gives rise to all of our wisdom. Prajnaparamita is what gives rise to Buddha, right? It's that fundamental unknowability. It goes way past language, way past concepts, way past division, way past. It goes even beyond itself. So there's that invitation to get really, really big. And again, this is on a personal note. I'm not sure how this shows up for other people, but one of the ways this shows up for me is the awareness that I'm always in front of a live audience, even if I'm alone. Everything's alive. Everything. It's vibrating. The universe isn't a bunch of dead objects and then me. The whole thing is flow. The whole thing is flow. It's energy. It's shifting. It's changing. It's dancing right in front of me. I'm in relationship with it. The podium, the microphone, the paper, the floor. This is a live audience. There's no such thing as a not live audience, right? It's all unfolding. I'm part of this unfolding. There isn't this alive thing and those not alive thing. I'm right back to Hakuin again and this being's idea. This is Buddha, right? The dynamic unfolding, the non-separateness of this observer and that observed, not being two. There's Prajnaparamita. There's the sky of samadhi. Holy cow. Holy cow. And when I understand that and I start to live from that place, there's the full moon of wisdom. I'm wise enough to regard you as not separate. As separate. Yep, it's separate, but not separate. Separate in my head, that's helpful. That way I can drive home in my car, not yours. Right? Separate in my head, but not separate in my heart, because now I forget. Right? I don't want to forget in my heart. How is our suffering different? So, I like to think of this. This idea gives me comfort. I'm always in front of this audience of infinite beings. In Buddhism, we might call this the ancestors. The infinite lineage of ancestors going all the way back to Buddha and infinitely before Buddha and all the way into the future and the infinite future beyond the future. And the 10 directions above and below, the past, the present, and future, the three worlds, the infinite cloud of witnesses, the communion of saints. I don't know what you want to call it. It doesn't matter what you call it. But the teaching being that this whole thing is dynamic and alive. The whole thing. And there is the possibility of changing our relationship with suffering when we realize that. Right? So, that was pretty abstract and a little trippy, frankly. So, to be a little less so, I happened to read this, I happened to be reminded of this when I was working on these talks a few weeks ago. That a lot of people still talk about an event in human history about 50 years ago that they pinpoint as a changing in the evolution of the human consciousness. And I like it because, to me, it ties in wonder, it ties in the lovely moon metaphor that Hakuin's using, it ties in the sky metaphor, it talks in seeing diversity as unity. And that event is what they call Earthrise. The photograph taken by, was it Apollo 8 or Apollo 10? The very first photograph when they were coming around the dark side of the moon, and they took a photograph of the Earth rising over the moon. And they talk about this as a changing point in the evolution of human consciousness because to have photographic evidence, this is actually what we are. One thing. You can see all of it at one time with your eyes. Everything that's ever been done, every painting ever painted, every piece of heartbreak, every triumph, every war, every birth, every death, every single thing that we can possibly conceive of as limited, tiny little human beings happened in that space. This little, tiny, blue marble in this infinite black sea. It's impossible not to be moved by that. And to see our planet rising over another is just jarring. Right? It's jarring. We're used to watching the moon rise. Oh, right, yeah, that thing's in relation to us. We're still the center, right? But to see us in relation to that is... Whew. So, this is one of the versions. You've all seen it. There's a lot of different versions of this photo, the Earth rise. Isn't that cool? For those of you at home, I'm showing a photo to the group of Earthrise. Look it up. So, one of the people who took those series of photographs, his name is William Anders. He was an astronaut, of course. He took it on Christmas Eve. I'm guessing if this was a Christian community, we would ascribe a whole bunch of meaning to that. Because it's pretty cool, right? The day before the birth of the light, we see our Earth as an undivided whole for the first time. It's pretty cool. So this photograph has been called the most influential environmental photograph ever taken. I can't possibly argue with that. I can't imagine anybody arguing with that. Joseph Campbell, you know the name Joseph Campbell. He's the one who really offered the idea we can never go back to the way we were. How do you think tribally anymore? How do you? There's no line between America and Canada here. There's no line between America and Mexico here. I can't see it. That's interesting. I see one. How can I say this part of the map wins and this part of the map right next to it loses? I mean, how do I do that anymore? I can't. I mean, I still do, right? Don't we? We're still doing that. We will continue to. But, you know, we can only live in denial for a certain amount of time. When something shifts, it shifts. And we'll argue about it and fight about it for a few more generations, but something shifted. Because we all know this is true. So, William Anders said about taking that photograph and about his experience. Suddenly, from behind the rim of the moon, in long, slow-motion movements of immense majesty, there emerges a sparkling blue and white jewel, a light. A delicate sky-blue sphere laced with slowly swirling veils of white, rising gradually like a small pearl in the thick sea of black mystery. It takes me more than a moment to fully realize that this is Earth. This is home. Instead of an intellectual search, there was suddenly a very deep gut feeling that something was different. It occurred when looking at Earth and seeing this blue and white planet floating there and knowing it was orbiting the sun and seeing that sun and seeing it set in the background of the very deep black and velvety cosmos, seeing rather knowing for sure that there was a purposefulness of flow, energy, time, space in the cosmos that was beyond our rational ability to understand, but suddenly there was a non-rational way of understanding that had been beyond all of my previous experience. There seems to be more to the universe than random, chaotic purposelessness. I suddenly experienced the universe in that moment as intelligent, loving, and harmonious. So to me, that's a beautiful passage, and it's about the last thing I would ever expect a scientific astronaut to say. That sounds more like somebody who's just had an experience of ecstasy, a religious experience, we would call it, a spiritual experience, a Kensho experience, something like that, right? He's giving that description from a deeply human place, right? The witness that you just heard the voice of is no longer a white male NASA astronaut. He is speaking on behalf of the human organism. Does that make sense? Do you kind of get a sense of that when you hear it? Like, yeah, that's right. I wasn't even there and I know that that's right. He wasn't having a personal experience. He's having a giant experience. Non-rational way of understanding. Wow, is that ever zen? Zen is not anti-intellectual. Rationality has a great place for us. Really, really important tool. But Zen really does emphasize there is another way of knowing that is too big to fit inside your mind. But there is another way of knowing, and it's just as true. In fact, it's more true. Right? When you sit down on the cushion, the Song of Zazen promises you have an opportunity to express that very thing. You have an opportunity to express that very thing. So he finishes, and he doesn't finish. The poem actually goes on, but he finishes as far as we're concerned today with an expression of the wholeness of things as it is. The wholeness of things as it is. With the line, truly, is anything missing now? He actually answers that question, but I won't. Because it's a really great, that's a really great place to end this. Truly. I mean, it's like him saying, okay, so seriously, is anything missing? Because our normal way of saying is, yes, I'm right in the middle of trying to figure that out. Hello, that's my life. Of course it's missing. Have you seen my bank balance? Oh my God, my relationship with my wife has been so challenging, and my car, and I've got this job, and it's not satisfying, and it's so hot today, it's kind of muggy, but we can do Zazen outside, or Kenyan outside, or I don't know, my back hurts. God, I've been sitting here for 3 days. What's going on? Of course something's missing. Why isn't this lectern made of chocolate? God. There probably is a reason the lectern isn't made of chocolate, but I'll be darned if I know what it is. So I love this. I love this because he asked it in the form of a question. And it would have been so easy for him here to make an assertion. Nothing's missing. Thank you, Hakuin. You're starting to lecture me now. I like that he invites us in. Bring your experience into this. Ask yourself this question. And the cushion is a great place to ask this question. And also not the cushion. You know, the driver's seat is a good place to ask it. And when you're holding your tea or you're having breakfast or you're walking around the lake or you're sitting at your desk, they're all good places. The cushion's especially nice, though, because theoretically there's fewer distractions. And we can actually follow this breadcrumb trail. Because, yes, the default setting is, of course, something's missing. Something's broken. Something's wrong. Something's flawed. Something's right. And I know that because of dut, 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 dut. And I've got a whole bunch of like reasons why. I can give you a list of all the things that are missing. I can give you a list of all the things that I would prefer. That's easy for every human on the planet. Name 10 things off the top of your head that would make this moment better. Oh. Why just 10? I can think of a bunch of things. And so he's encouraging us. No, join your heart, your actual unfolding experience with this question. Is anything missing? Because all it will show you is your mind. The only thing that's missing is an idea you have, something you've imagined. There is no chocolate lectern. It's not missing. I can invent the idea. I can decide with my imagination that's a cool idea. And I can even decide to attach desire to it. Ooh, maybe my life would be more pleasurable if I had that. But all I'm seeing is my mind. There's nothing actually missing. Right? How is that even possible? There isn't, in the middle of my heartbreak, there's nothing missing. In the middle of my anger, there's nothing missing. Right? There's just anger there. It's full. I'm full having it. I'm not broken, waiting to be full when anger goes away. This is a whole being Buddha experiencing anger. This is a whole being Buddha having his heart broken. A whole being Buddha even wishing his lectern was made of chocolate. Right? It isn't an absence. There's nothing missing. In Zen, it's always, no, you have to figure this out for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Nothing's missing, sweetie. There you go. Off you go. I've patted your head. That solved nothing for you. Even if you believe that, it solved nothing for you. You have to see the earth rising from behind the moon to have your heart be broken open and have your life be transformed. You can't take my word for it. By the way, we're on this little blue thing, and we orbit this other blue thing. Okay, great. You've done nothing for me. I have to have my own heart pierced by that. I have to look for the thing that's missing in my own life and not be able to find it before I see how full it is, right? Bring me this mind that ails you. I've looked for the mind master and I cannot find it. There. I've put it at rest for you. Wow. Right? All these teachings do is show us a mirror. They're just mirror after mirror after mirror after mirror after mirror. Please don't hurt yourself. Please don't continue to hang on to these ideas that cause you so much suffering, that make you feel so lonely, that make you feel so cut off. Do you see that you're doing that, sweetheart? Please stop. Right? We're in loving relation. Your pain is my pain. We're together. Please, look for this thing that you think is missing. Don't take my word for it. Look for it. Look for this thing. And you'll find your fullness. You'll find your lacking nothingness. So we work with this. We work with this. We work with it. Sitting after sitting, moment after moment. Session after session, year after year. Unfolding, unfolding, unfolding. There's no failure. It's impossible. No failure. We just discover it. We just discover it at our own pace. And we have all sorts of people to support us doing it. So I'm going to end with a poem by Jane Hirschfield. I must be in a poetry place, maybe. Because I'm responding to a poem, and now I'm having her respond to me responding to a poem. Oh, God. I'm going to need a flow chart to start explaining all this stuff. Do you guys know Jane Hirschfield, some of you? I'm seeing some nods, yeah. If you don't know her, boy, do a search on her after you've searched out Earthrise. She's fantastic. She wrote a poem called Recalling a Song Dynasty Landscape. It's based on a Song Dynasty landscape painting, but that's not too important to know. It's a short poem. She says, "Palest wash of stone-rubbed ink leaves open the moon. Unpainted circle, how does it raise so much light? Below, the mountains lose themselves in dreaming, a single thatched roofed hut. Not that the hut lends meaning to the mountains or to the moon. It is a place to rest the eye after much traveling is all. And the heart, unscrolled, is comforted by such small things. A cup of green tea rescues us and grows deep and large, a lake." So this is the landscape of our lives. It doesn't belong to Jane Hirschfield. It doesn't belong to Song Dynasty China. It does not belong to astronaut William Anders. It does not belong to a man we refer to affectionately as the Buddha, living and dying 2,500 years ago. It does not belong to Hakuin. It is our landscape. It is your landscape. And we rest our eye after much traveling. You've all been traveling. You all bring a certain degree of pain, weariness from the road. We're told there's comfort in small things. We are told that we are Buddha. We're told that holding a cup of tea can open into a lake. We're told that beholding a photo of the earth rising from behind the moon can open our hearts and change our lives. But we don't feel that comfort until our heart unscrolls. Until our heart unscrolls, those are just words. And so we practice. And so we practice. We practice the awareness of these small things. There's the teacup. There's the podium. There's the floor. There's my breath. There's the emotion. There's the bones and muscles. We practice this until the heart unscrolls, and then we start to take comfort. And we can take comfort and contentment in even pain, in even heartbreak. We can be in the middle of great heartbreak and not need anything to be different. To not experience it as lack. To see it as full. To see it as full. And ourselves part of it. So when we ask our life to give us comfort, it won't. When we ask our teacup to give us comfort, it won't. But when we offer the teacup or our life the gift of our kind attention, when we give our attention away to it, we give ourselves away to it, then comfort. Then freedom. Then freedom. Give your life away to a teacup later today. Make yourself a cup of tea and give your life away to it. You will find comfort and freedom in that moment. To the degree you give yourself away to it, you will find comfort and freedom. You will. So this moment of awareness is the hut. This moment of awareness is the moon. This moment of awareness is your life, and it is bathed as Jane Hirschfield says, in the unpainted light of original enlightenment. It is exquisite and luminous. It is expansive. It is tingling with energy. It is your awakeness. It is the awakeness. The rest, she describes, isn't drowsy. It isn't lazy. It isn't unresponsive. It's Buddha. And it's filled with infinite ripples of subtle awareness. This is the peace that passeth understanding. So this is your mind, and it's the field of our practice. And we are rescued, just like she says. The tea becomes deep and large like our lives. We experience it as expansive freedom, and we're rescued. And we realize we've always been rescued. Thank you very much.